This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc-Olivier Dumablet.
And I'm Yannick Mignon.
And what's our topic for this week, Yannick?
My 2023 work year in UI frameworks.
Ooh. But before you start, you also have some follow-up.
Yes, I do. Starting off with a big surprise this week that I was definitely not expecting. This is follow-up for episode 179, The Vibe, The Structure, The Journey on Gran Turismo 7. On that episode, we gave our opinion about the game, which was, well, at least mine was not very positive. I think yours was more mixed at the time, and I think that may have changed over time.
Change? I wouldn't say so. I think it's still mixed feelings.
It's true that you haven't played it since we recorded that episode, so that certainly helps.
That's fair.
But yeah, so on that episode, we also mentioned like the possibility, since there is an established pattern of Polyphony Digital releasing big rework patches down the line, we were speculating about what if there's Gran Turismo 7 Spec 2? Well, surprise, surprise, on day of recording, Gran Turismo 7 Spec 2 was released today. So I actually installed this morning. I came back on the lunch break and I just booted it up to see if it was running. I do have some tiny thoughts, but for the most part, I haven't had the time to play it because I have to make a video and this podcast this week. I don't have time to play games. So I'm going to go through the changelog really quickly. GT Sophie 2.0, which is the artificial intelligence that they were working on for racing in Gran Turismo, version 2.0 is now available on PS5, and it is integrated into regular gameplay, which is really, really cool. This means that unlike a Sophie 1.0, which was only available in a limited time event and it with four cars, now Sophie can use 95% of cars in the game, which is really impressive. So there are a bunch of modes and events that have been reworked to use the Sophie AI, which is really cool. There are seven new cars. There's a new Canadian snow track called Lake Louise. There is arcade mode has been reworked into something called Quick Race, which gives added rewards when you decide to do a quick race against Sophie, which is good. There is an event directory UI, which lets you navigate events as a group instead of having to find them track to track. So if you remember in the original campaign, you had, like, let's say, North American Sunday Cup 500 or whatever, and you had to find all of the North American racetracks that have that event on it if you wanted to complete that event, in quotes. And completing events didn't actually serve a purpose in the campaign, and that's sort of part of the problem. But now event directory lets you browse them like you would in an older Gran Turismo game, but let's be honest, the UI is, it has no personality. It just looks like a boring table. It sucks, but at least it's there. There's now weekly challenge events, which gives you more credits and more roulette tickets depending on how many events you clear each week, which is really cool. They also have like a counter on the home screen now, so you can see how many of the five weekly challenges you've completed, which is great for player retention. There are three extra menu books, which are post-campaign. Meeting Place, that feature that let you go to a track and sort of go to a lobby with other players that is persistent and always there, that has been replaced with something called the Paddock, which is basically the same thing, except it is presenting the lobby as a parking lot of cars, and you can react to other people's cars with emoji. It's a really cool feature. Looking forward to testing that. Something I think you will like is that there are 50 new master license tests available.
That's cool, but that's not what I was waiting for.
You were waiting for what exactly? Well, I guess I'll finish the list and afterwards you can tell
finish
me.
Finish the list, yeah. Yes.
Four-player split screen?
Yes, PS5 only.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. No, I have the list in front of me, PS5 only.
Yeah. Slower shutter speeds now available in photo mode. And a redone progression dashboard. So that is the full change log for Gran Turismo 7 Spec 2. Pretty meaty update. Came kind of out of nowhere, although I think I'm not actively following the Gran Turismo esports circuit, but I think like the finals are very soon. So I think like they're going to be playing on Spec 1 for the finals, and then Spec 2 is going to be like for the next year of the circuit. So maybe we're going to be seeing one of these patches like every year. I don't know. Maybe that's wishful thinking, but I think it could be pretty cool.
I guess time will tell, but I think When you confuse, I think the part at the beginning where you say, my opinion evolve is you mixing with Gran Turismo Sport, which I did. I forgot, I don't have the episode name in front of me, but I did revisit down the road where, because of those monthly updates for the last, for the, I think it was a period of 2-3 years just before Gran Turismo, it kind of was, I won't dare to say the saving grace of Gran Turismo Sport, but it was really an improvement. So if they keep the same strategy, which they seem to have, right? They did add monthly updates, and now it seems that they have a bigger update. For Gran Turismo Sport, the bigger update was literally adding the campaign. But now, I guess, we shall see. Don't get me wrong, like, you've sent me a few of the promo videos, and I was like, oh, maybe it's time for me to go look at it again. The holiday season is close by, so maybe I'll have time to play some video games at that time and maybe revisit Gran Turismo 7.
I had uninstalled Gran Turismo 7 a couple of months ago, so there were updates that I had seen go by that I was excited for, but it wasn't enough to get me to reinstall it. And now I have like this backlog of cars that I have to go and check out. Like, I want to go ride the ambulance around the track. Like, that sounds fun.
There's an ambulance? Oh, I missed this update.
Yeah, there's a, I think it's a Toyota Hi-Medic or something like that, that you can just drive around the track. So I am looking forward to playing around with that. I bought a bunch of cars that came out in prior updates as well that I haven't really had the time to put through their paces. So I don't know, maybe there are enough events now that I can use my Group 1 and Group 2 cars and more things. So I'm going to be looking into that, and I'm honestly considering, I'm so overloaded for the rest of the year, so I don't know if I can actually do this, but I kind of want to do a video comparing GT7 and Forza. I'm thinking about it, but I also have to front load all of my video production for early next year because I'm going to be in Japan, so that's tricky, but yeah, I'll see what I can do. Otherwise, maybe that's just going to be a podcast.
So, you haven't guessed what I was looking for, and looking at my notes here, it seems that I missed an update that did update this feature that I really enjoyed of Gran Turismo 7. You're still thinking about what it is.
Yeah, is it the chart where you see the price history over time?
No. Okay. I'll stop teasing. Music rallies.
Oh yeah, I forgot because I hate that feature.
To me, it is one of the rare modes because you forget an 8 about it, but a lot of people forget about it because it's a different, like,
it's from not the, in the menu.
No, it's not in the menu. It's like you have to boot the game and then change the mode literally in the game. But
it's true. They added some a couple of months ago.
Yeah, and I missed this update because I would assume that the update 135 is from a few months back. And it seems that, okay, then maybe I'll boot up the game and play some because I really enjoyed those stages. So now I get to see them.
I'm going to boot it up and I'm going to go check what songs there are. And if there are songs that I like, I'll do them. If there aren't, I'm just going to skip it.
Chances are, I don't have my hopes too high for this, but yeah.
Just put, like, something from GT2 and something from GT4, and I'll be happy.
Okay, that's fair.
As long as it's not, like, just classical music. Like, canon in D, it doesn't count. It's in Gran Turismo 4, but it doesn't count. Clair de Lune, same deal. Like, I know these classical music songs already. Like, please just use your licensed tracks of your own soundtracks. They're so good.
If I look at the list I have here, there's Ocon Classic Parts 1 and 2. And there's Vroom, Survive, Hungarian Dance Number 5.
Yeah.
Green Monster, Can't Stop the Classic, The Good Old Days Classics with 2X, I don't know why, Remix, Drift, Maritira, I guess. We'll see. I guess you'll find it on the web. I don't want to pronounce this. Hook on America and Life's Coming In Show. And last but not least, Moon Over the Castle GT7 version are the 11 stages at this point.
Okay, so basically nothing from GT4 or GT2. Okay, so I'm just going to continue pretending this mode doesn't exist.
I guess.
Anyway, let's move on to another a subset of PlayStation. This is follow-up for episode 202. We just want better excuses to shoot things, which was about Destiny 2's approach to the games as a service model. Did you forget that Bungie belongs to Sony?
No.
Oh, you just thought the title was funny?
Yes, of course. Come on. No, I'm still reminded that I need to find some inkling of me believing that you're not putting those titles in your notes. But
sure, whatever. But this is not a funny matter. 8% of Bungie was laid off this week, with management citing that Destiny 2's underperformance in the last year was responsible for it. They were 45% below target revenue and retention numbers, which sounds pretty bad. Layoffs seem to hit some pretty high profile people in just about every department except for senior management. Surprise, surprise. Destiny basically doesn't have any community managers anymore, which is weird. Like, no one, like everybody people knew, they're all gone. So that's strange. Bungie also laid off a composer that has been making music for their games almost exclusively since 1997 and sort of defines the sound of Destiny. So that is incredibly fucked up. So that's weird. And the games have been delayed, of course, because of this. So Destiny 2 Final Shape has been delayed until June 2024. That was originally stated for release in February 2024. I am somewhat happy about this delay because I was going to miss the release of the final Destiny 2 expansion, or the quote final Destiny 2 expansion. I know it's not the actual final Destiny 2 expansion, but the closure of the original story arc, let's say. This means that Destiny 2 players will have 4 extra months to wait out with no planned content drops, and considering that engagement is at an all-time low for the game, that's not good. Apparently the reason that they have been delaying the Final Shape is that when they were playtesting the game, they were only getting good reactions, not great, which is certainly not what you want from the finale of your big story arc that has been happening over the last 10 years. And I think people would probably be okay with the delay if you hadn't laid off the people who actually make Destiny great.
Yeah, that's worrisome.
Yeah, so lots of doom and gloom around Destiny fans this week. And honestly, it sucks for everyone who lost their jobs. 2023 has been an absolutely terrible year for video game layoffs. Well, probably just layoffs in general in every industry.
Yeah, I would say, Leo.
But video games have had it especially rough, I would say. I think Destiny 2 Lightfall was not a very good expansion to begin with, and then on top of that, having 2023 for people with normal gaming tastes being like a year of nonstop bangers kind of doesn't help Destiny, which only sort of coasts on the fact that it's always there. If there's nothing cool coming out this week, you can always go back to Destiny and have a pretty good time. But this year, there has just been stuff every week that has been better than Destiny, so why would you play it? So, kind of awkward there. Also, let's not forget about Marathon, which is the upcoming Bungie game. Marathon has been pushed back to 2025, although I don't think anyone was actually realistically expecting anyone to see anything Marathon related in 2024 at all, except maybe a beta. So I don't think people care as much about this one, because I think everyone had internalized already that it would be 2025, so sure. There is a report going around that the reason for the delay is that Bungie brought in a bunch of players of Escape from Tarkov, which is another extraction shooter like Marathon is supposed to be. They got them to sit down and play Marathon, and then the follow-up question was, how many of you would stream this? And nobody raised their hand. So that does not sound good. I would also say Escape from Tarkov is a super hyper-realistic military sim game, and Marathon is a neon sci-fi aesthetic game. I don't think these people are going to be interested in Marathon. I am interested in Marathon. I would never fucking touch Escape from Tarkov, okay? So the target audience is not the same, so I don't think this should be used to justify that the game sucks, okay? But whatever, I don't work at Bungie, and if I did, they would probably lay me off. So that is it for the Bungie Watch this week. I'm going to put a bunch of links to, at the very least, videos from YouTubers in the Destiny community that I enjoy, and I believe by the time that this episode comes out, there's going to be a full podcast with a bunch of Destiny YouTubers talking about this. That I'm very much looking forward to. It's just not out at time of recording. So look for that if you care about Destiny 2. But if you care about Destiny, you probably know all of this already, and you are probably able to find it yourself. But sure, it'll be in the show notes just in case. Anyway, that's it for follow-up. Let's go into the main topic. So one of the quirks of working at a product design company that handles a wide variety of multidisciplinary projects is that I get to play with a lot of technologies very quickly. Like, I've touched a lot of shit this year that I have never touched before, and it's really cool. Each project has its own stable of technologies to explore, and particularly relevant to this show, we talk a lot about UI frameworks, especially on mobile, because let's be honest, that's where the money tends to be. And one of the sort of sad things about Lucrative's job is that... I'm speaking for myself, not for you.
Okay. I wasn't sure.
Is because his job is specific to native iOS development, he only really gets to explore other UI frameworks if Apple decides to replace UIKit or SwiftUI with a new thing, which happens rarely, like maybe once every 15 years.
Oh, I forgot to tell you, I changed job literally like 3 minutes ago, and now I'm a web developer.
Oh, fuck. Now, the other opportunity that Lucrative would have to play around with other UI frameworks is if someone screwed up and decided to swap a product to a multi-platform framework, which as far as I know hasn't happened.
That's fair.
But, I mean, you've said on the show previously that if someone proposed to you that you would use React Native for your job, you would just leave your job, probably.
Probably, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, and I believe my follow-up to that was, I probably wouldn't. I would play around with it to get to know the thing that I hate. And that's precisely what I've done. So, I've played around with three different mobile UI frameworks throughout the year on various projects and assignments. And I thought, since I didn't have any better ideas, I would just share some hot takes about UI frameworks on this episode.
Wow. Seriously, I was so eager for this topic. But now with this introduction, where I am partly to blame, I'm not so sure. Maybe it's my time to just rage quit. So bye-bye.
That was my last joke about you. So I think you should be fine.
That's fair.
We're going to start off with native Android development. And for all of these, I'm going to give a little bit of context. But of course, obviously, I am NDA'd, so I can't say too much. So I'm going to stay vague. But you're going to know just enough to know in what kind of project I was working with these technologies. So native Android in particularly,
Give me a sec. Let me describe it. You work on an Android app with Android phones.
Well, that's a bit
too vague. Is that vague enough?
It's also incorrect. Come on. So I need to add functionality to a rudimentary Android tablet app that was written by another firm for a client. So they came in with the app already, and we just had to add some features to it. This firm had a lot of ex-Google employees at it, so actually I was pretty surprised with the quality of the code of the application. It served as a pretty good example of what a proper Android app should be structured like, which was really good for onboarding new developers, because usually when we get a project, a lot of the times it's complete disarray, and it's like, okay, don't do anything like the code base currently does it. Do it a different way. Here it's just like, no, just look at the class. Do like the class you're already in, and it's going to be pretty good. To clarify, because there are multiple native Android dev Android UI frameworks, I'm talking about the original native Android framework, whose last major revision was around the time of Google I/O 2011, which is when I was there. So Honeycomb Ice Cream Sandwich era, back when they introduced tablet apps to the platform for the first time. This is not Jetpack Compose, which is essentially the Swift UI analog on Android, which is the new recommended UI framework for Kotlin, according to Google. So this original native Android framework has the primary components of activities, fragments, and views. So activities, they simultaneously kind of represent something like a full screen presentation view controller and something like an NS user activity. Basically, like when you see icons in your app launcher, they're technically not app launching icons, they're activity launcher app icons. An application can provide multiple activities, and some of them can be available in the launcher. So I think one of the classics was like the Google News app used to also do weather. So you used to have a news and a weather icon, but they were technically both for the same app, but different activities. Then later in Honeycomb, which was the first tablet-only version of the OS, essentially the analog to 3.2, iPadOS 3.2, which, honestly, like, most people probably don't remember, but it's one of my favorite iOS releases of all time, so that's why I remember it. Fragments are essentially the analog to view controller containment. So they were essentially made to allow for UIs designed for the phone to be embedded into a larger layout on tablets. So, for example, if you have a master detail view, you want your master column to be a phone view from your previous Apple. You would rework it so that the phone activity would become a fragment of the left column, and then your right column would be a different fragment, and you could embed sub fragments in there. So like I said, view controller containment is basically the analog in the iOS world for that. And then views are just views. They're like you would expect from any regular imperative UI framework. Native Android feels like a throwback in a good way. It reminds me a lot of early UIKit. I think mainly because they were developed around the same time and they have a lot of similar concepts with different names. If you are using Android Studio, you can define your user interfaces in XML as text, or you can use the visual editor, but it is definitely not as rich as IB. When you are editing your views visually, you can give them IDs, like text IDs, but these text IDs are actually auto-compiled into a constant class definition, kind of like an enum kind of thing. So you can ensure that your ID exists in your UI before asking for it in your code. Whenever you have to register like button presses or whatever, it uses traditional Java event listeners. This can be clunky in Java if you implement your listeners as anonymous classes, because remember that Java for a long time did not have closures. So you had to define anonymous classes with an interface, which is weird as hell.
Yes.
If you're
surprisingly, I have to deal with that sometimes.
Really? Oh, because of GUID stuff?
Yes.
Yeah. And however, if you're using Kotlin, this is all transparent. It just looks like a closure. So one more reason to use Kotlin. In fact, the only reason we didn't use Kotlin is because the application was entirely written in Java already. And I think most people on the team had more familiarity with Java already than Kotlin. If we had written the app from scratch, we would probably have gone with Kotlin though. And for me, native Android, it was really refreshing. And I was kind of surprised by this, but also not at the same time. And the reason I felt surprised by it is because there are so many pressures everywhere in the tech industry towards FRP UI frameworks, whether it's React Native, which we'll talk about later, Flutter, which we'll talk about later, Swift UI, React on the Web, Angular, like all of these frameworks are all pushing the same kind of idea. And I think I've made it pretty clear on the Swift UI episode in the past that I think there are certain types of applications that that approach is really useful for. And I think it can be more useful in some contexts more than others, like on the web. But ultimately, I'm not sold on it being a one-size-fits-all solution to all of our problems as application developers. And being able to use a mature imperative UI development framework that has been battle tested after like however many years it's been since the first version of Android, I think 14. Android 14 just came out, so I'm going to say 14.
Yeah, let's say 15 just for the sake of rounding it up.
Yeah. Like this UI framework works very well, even though it's not necessarily the one I'm accustomed to. And pretty much anything you would want to do, you can do. You can customize basically everything. I always feel like with FRP frameworks, I am boxed in and limited to what they decided to expose to us. And in imperative frameworks, a lot of times because they are older, they just have more knobs and dials you can tweak with. And I feel free to do the work that I need to do instead of being boxed in, which I think is good. So while I can't say I'm a fan of Java, the language, in conjunction with the actual framework provided by Google in this case, it wasn't too bad. And I actually enjoyed it. It's like I said, it felt refreshing. I had fun working on these projects. Okay, I'm going to qualify that. I had fun working on the app development parts of the project. There were other parts of the project that were less fun. But yeah, so it was pretty enjoyable experience. And I was honestly surprised at how far it had come since the last time I had touched the framework. So it, like, we weren't even recording the show back then. I used to have a T-Mobile G1, the very first Android phone that was released in the U.S., and sort of most of my Android messing around was done on that device back in the day. And that was like Android 1.6, 2.3 range of versions. Very, very early Android. And the UI framework was basically unusable. And it's in that period with Honeycomb and Ice Cream Sandwich when Matias Duarte sort of redid the whole UI language and materials started coming out and all of that stuff that Android sort of got good, and it shows in the framework. It's actually kind of usable, and it's pretty good. I had a good time. So, yeah, thumbs up for native Android. You didn't think I was going to say that on this episode, right?
No, I was not expecting that, but now with the explanation, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and you name drop a few things that I haven't heard in a long while, including the Google designer that did material. I don't know if they're still at Google at this point.
I don't think Matias Duarte is still at Google.
But yeah, it reminds me of the old time, like the introduction of Android and iOS that was years ago. Let's put it this way.
Yeah, actually, this period, Honeycomb, Ice Cream Sandwich, predates Material. It's still Holo design language at this point. So it was like the in-between between old Android, which is basically hideous, and and then Material, which came, I think, around the Nexus 4, I want to say.
Which was my last... not that I ever really daily drive an Android phone, but that was the last time I played with an Android phone and had even one in my possession.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the next framework, which is one we have hinted at many times in the past, which is React Native, because it is one of the more popular ones on the market right now. The context for this is that the company has a lot of active React Native projects on the stores and whatnot, and I had a lot of maintenance tasks to do on existing applications because for some reason or another, maintainers left the company, so it fell on me. Also, I've been in charge of configuring CI and CD pipelines for automated Android and iOS builds of these applications throughout the year, so I sort of had to get more familiar with it. And React Native is really interesting because I think the business case for it is incredibly good. And then you have to develop in it and sort of stops being fun then. As someone who is already familiar with React for web development, like React Native is incredibly intuitive. It is basically transparent. You basically don't have to learn anything if you're a React developer. Because developing for the web with React essentially trains you to use arbitrarily named components as building blocks for your application, not just standard HTML elements. So traditionally, if you're writing an HTML web page or whatever, you're going to have like your standard semantic tags, or you're going to have like article, header, not sidebar, but nav, and all of these like HTML5 tags that represent various concepts. And you can continue to use those in React Native as well, but the entire point of React Native is to be able to spin up your own components that live alongside those base components by composing subcomponents and all of that stuff. And eventually, you're just going to be building mostly with arbitrarily named components, whether you wrote them or they come from an external framework. React Native basically just says, okay, same idea. You're building a hierarchy of components in JSX, which is like their JavaScript plus HTML hybrid thing that they have. It's like a templating language. It's actually a templating language because it compiles to a JavaScript nested functions and all of that stuff in the background. But essentially, it just says, okay, all of your old HTML tags, forget those. Now we're giving you new base tags that are based on native UI components that are provided by the underlying platform. So you have real iOS buttons if you're on iOS. You have real iOS nav bars and all of these various concepts that exists on both iOS and on Android they provide a common interface to these components, and you can just use them like if they were normal React components, or actually if they were native HTML elements, and you can just build your UI like that. This does have a counter effect, though, because you are still going to be in web developer mode when you are writing these applications. And that means that you are going to be thinking of your solutions as a web developer and not as a mobile developer. And that means that you are going to probably forget about things that are available on mobile that you probably should be doing but are not doing. For example, swipeable table view cells, or even table views in general. You don't have to think about table view cell reuse because you're probably not using table views at all in your application. You're just using a bunch of repeated, basically a stack of views up on one another in a scroll view. Which, yes, I heard that sound you made. I agree.
Hey, don't get me wrong. It is fine up until you end up with a huge collection of data, right?
Exactly.
At least, I guess that's the benefit of all of those A chip from Apple. It's like now they're pretty performant, so yeah, they can render like 100 views without any problems at 60 FPS.
We've come a long way from the Tweety era when you had to override draw rect to get good performance in your table views and draw all of your labels by hand. I remember those days.
And it's funny how those days were kind of no longer remembered, because I remember doing that in small projects while I was doing iOS development. And in one of my university internships, what I was doing iOS development, which was around just before iOS 7? Yeah, something like that. Or just after the launch of iOS 7. So a few years back, where you could just use normal UI view elements in your table view cells. And then people were like, what? What do you mean you're using DrawRec? I'm like, that's how you make performant table views. No, you can just put views now. It's like, yes, I know, but DrawRec is better. Not easier. It's just better for performance.
Yep.
So the old time.
Yep. I think like iPhone 5 period is kind of where people stopped doing that and just went the whole just use labels and subviews and stuff. And I think for the most part, it has been fine. But yeah, like we have come a long way since the iPhone 5. And now, for the most part, React Native, you can just stack things and a lot of applications, it's fine, but I still get that feeling in my body, which is like, oh, I don't like it. Speaking of things I don't like, another thing that is not really being handled by web developers who use React Native is stuff like navigation controllers and stacks. Like, I don't see very much of that view controller presentation. Like, everyone is sort of manipulating the mobile canvas as if it was a web page. And because those things don't exist in web pages, they don't care and they don't think about those things. Another thing is like split views or master detail controllers like that. Forget it. You're never actually going to get people to use the actual native controls for that. They're going to invent their own alternative or use some JavaScript library that does some approximation of it. And
oh boy,
that's the thing, is like, even though React Native claims to give you native solutions to all of your problems, it requires the developers to opt into using those things. And a lot of them will just be, on the web, all you have are divs. I'm going to solve all my problems with divs. And that's what they do. And
oh no,
it says a lot about the quality of a lot of React Native applications that is the approach that is taken. It's like, well, yeah, you're basically just having a more performant web page, but you're still thinking about it in terms of a web page. And this includes stuff like, I complain about this incessantly and people are tired of hearing me talk about it, but web developers have never really had to think about memory management or resource management at all, because they are used to the idea that because they are in a web page, worst case, the tab is going to crash and you're going to reload the page and you're going to be right back where you are. This is not how mobile apps work. This is not how Electron apps work.
Mm-hmm.
And web developers just don't think about these things. And this is important if you're on a mobile device, even though they have gotten much more powerful than the iPhone 1. It's still good to think about those things. And basically, like, you see no real thought about resource management anywhere in these applications. And that also makes me cringe as a longtime native dev.
Yeah. And I think even a bigger example of that is right now, listener, if you're near a desktop computer, open its activity monitor and go see at your RAM usage. And you'll see if you have left your browser of choice with a few tabs open for more than 3 hours, some of them might become consuming gigs of RAMs, which to me is mind-boggling that in 2023 I really have to close Safari because I have like 20 tabs and all of them are consuming more or less 50 megabyte to 1 gig. But yeah, that's the world we live in these days.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So kind of on the same topic of like web developers, they think about things as if it was a web page and therefore they have like blindness to entire aspects of the platform that is available to them. There's like the smoke screen that I keep talking about when I'm talking about the problems with React Native. It's like a smoke screen of ignorance where you don't have to pay attention to the underlying platform at all. And I think we kind of touched on this on the previous episode, and it's still top of mind for me because I've been writing about it this week at work internally. It's that even though you're using a framework like React Native where you do not touch native APIs directly, the decisions that are made by the underlying platform still impact you directly. When Android decides that there are changes to the permission model, that necessarily probably implies that you are going to have to upgrade a library somewhere. You may actually have to revise some or all of the code that uses that library to get permissions. Because maybe you need to ask for a different permission. Maybe you need to check the OS version to ask for a specific permission in one version and not on the other version. And all of that stuff, which is announced publicly during developer conferences every year and during in native Android documentation, none of that is bubbled up anywhere in the React Native docs. It just assumes that you know and that you keep up with these things. But nobody keeps up with these things. So you have people who are writing applications for an underlying platform that they know nothing about, and then they are caught by surprise when things don't work as they expect it to because they are thinking entirely in a web-based mindset. And it drives me crazy. And I think, like, more than the technology itself, like, the technology itself, if you use it correctly, it's pretty good. Like, I don't agree with its philosophy necessarily, or I wouldn't choose it myself if I didn't have, like, a bunch of business factors that influence me towards that technology. But if you use it correctly, the technology is fine. It's just nobody uses it correctly. Nobody has all the information that they need to make good decisions with this platform. And everyone is just a chicken running with their head off. And it's kind of infuriating. And that's kind of why I don't like React Native. It's not so much the technology itself. It's the mindset that the developers that are using it have. And it's also like the entire value proposition for React Native. It's you don't have to learn anything. Your web skills adapt directly. And it's true. You can make actual shipping applications without adapting anything from your web development skills that you already have. It's just you're not going to be making the best app you can make. And that pisses me off because I like making the best apps I can make. And yeah, that's the big issue with React Native. All right, let's move on to the last framework, which I believe we have never officially talked about on the show before, which is Flutter. And the context behind my usage of Flutter is we were negotiating with a client that has existing Flutter apps, and they want us to develop a new app for them, but they also want to be able to reuse code from that app in their existing apps. So knowing that, we sort of knew that we were going to be pushed in that direction by the client, and I needed to whip up together a quick proof of concept to validate that, yes, it's viable for what we are actually trying to do. So that's sort of the context in which I was actually evaluating Flutter a couple months ago. And as of last week, I am actually working on I'm leading the project that this was about. So that's pretty cool. So Flutter uses the Dart language, Now, Dart is an interesting little language. Do you remember where Dart came from?
I don't remember, but isn't it one of those Google language again?
It's a Google language, yeah. It's from an era where Google wanted to flex their Chrome market share by replacing JavaScript with their own language.
Oh, that's where it came from.
Yeah, and for a while they built a Dart runtime directly into Chrome, and then they realized, no one else wants to integrate this language into their browser. It could be a competitive advantage for Chrome. And then they were just like, there's too much momentum around JavaScript, which is incredibly depressing at the same time. So we're going to keep using JavaScript. So putting aside the political aspects of Dart, it's a pretty cool language that avoids a lot of JavaScript's vestigial mistakes that we're stuck with. And this is something I repeat quite a bit, is that the problem with JavaScript is that for a variety of reasons, browsers have committed to ensure that web pages written in 1995 never break. So every mistake that was made in JavaScript, and there are a lot of them, are permanently in stone. And basically, the only things you can remove from JavaScript are features that were never implemented in more than one browser. So I think like one of the examples that comes to mind is, I don't remember if it's in IndexedDB, but there was a database format that was basically only implemented in Firefox. And everyone else was like, nah, that's too stupid. We're not going to implement that one. We're going to implement our own instead. And eventually, like, everyone was just like, we're never going to implement this thing that was only in Firefox, so let's just forget it. And I think Firefox removed it eventually. Pages that were written exclusively for like that range of versions of Firefox are broken. But if you wrote something in 1995 that uses all the wacky features of JavaScript, it will work forever. So it's nice that Dart is kind of like a fresh reset, and they can make their own mistakes, and they can also sometimes break compatibility to fix their mistakes instead of just being set in stone. You will always have undefined and all be different things and not a number and all of that garbage. Syntactically, it's pretty similar to JavaScript. Philosophically, it's closer to a Lua, which I like Lua a lot, which is pretty nice. But it has all of the type stuff that people like that I don't like. And it has a heavy encouragement towards immutable data types, which I can live with. So I've got a good and bad breakdown for this one. Let's start off with the good. It's not just limited to mobile development. You can also develop Flutter applications for web, Windows, Mac, and Linux. And the important thing here is they all have full official support. We were looking last year at the possibility of having a React Native application that could also export to the web. And what we discovered is that this is only possible through an unofficial... It's technically a Facebook project, but it's not. They're not committing to maintain it. So it's like, you're not really going to stick with that if you want your application to have a future longer than a year. And basically, like, all of the desktop platforms and the web platforms on React Native, they're either unofficial or like publicly labeled as second-class citizens with an uncertain future. So you kind of don't want to build applications on React Native on those platforms if you're serious about the long life of your product.
This is something I would have expected more from a Google product than a Facebook product. So I'm a bit surprised by that.
I think Facebook has a very similar track record to Google in terms of abandoning development projects a couple years into it. Facebook pop comes to mind because I got stung by that one.
Yes. Or what was it? What was the other one that was the async UI kit equivalent?
Yeah. I think it was async UI kit.
Oh, wow. Okay. But that was a funny one, too.
Yeah. The next good point is that Flutter, at least from what I've seen, it's much less of a dependency hell than a JavaScript environment. I generated a Hello World project, and I had about 30 package dependencies, which is nothing. It's still a lot if you're coming from the iOS world, let's be honest.
I'm surprised that even you're saying it's nothing, but...
So here's the exercise. I also generated a fresh React Native Hello World project. Tell me how many packages are in that one.
150.
1,700. Oh, that is not a joke.
Oh, boy.
That is actually the package count from when I ran npm install, and it said like 1726 packages installed.
Oh boy.
And that's just a Hello World app that doesn't do anything. Yep.
Yeah.
So now you see why I was excited about 30.
Yeah, no. I assumed that you being excited at 30 meant something, but not that big of a scale.
I'm pretty sure the Hello World app repo was something like 30 megs, and then the React Native one was like 1.5 gigs or something.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
It's hard not to make jokes about npm because it's npm. It does exactly what everyone jokes about. It's not even a joke, really. It's just saying the truth. It's just, it sounds insane, and this is the norm everywhere. It makes you feel like you're going crazy when you develop in a JavaScript environment. That's it for the good. Now you okay. I'm going to add another point in here that is technically not in my notes because someone else at work brought it up to me, and it is a good point. One of the aspects of Flutter that is interesting, more so on the Android side than on the iOS side, is that the entire focus is around high responsiveness, high frame rate applications. And Android has historically had an issue with responsive, high frame rate applications. And on Android, Flutter, for some reason, bypasses, well, I know the reason, I'm going to say it later, but it completely bypasses all of the issues that exist at the framework level at Android that make every app run slowly and horribly, and people on Android like it because it runs more smoothly. And like, sure, I'm not an Android user,
huh,
but you get better performance out of Flutter on Android than you do out of the native UI frameworks, which I think says a lot about the native UI frameworks.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So I've heard a lot about Flutter, not the framework itself, but the reason why we should use it. A few years ago, it was considered at work. I won't say more than that, a bit like same reasons as Yannick. But I remember that one of the points you mentioned is that like, it is really a cross-platform tool because it also does like desktops, all the desktops and all mobile OSs. But I was not aware that it was more performant on Android than the default frameworks.
Apparently.
Wow. Wow.
And you'll find out in a little bit why it's faster than the native frameworks.
Is it because it doesn't do garbage collection?
No. No. Oh my god. Can you imagine? If it had no garbage collection, I would be screaming about it on the top of the rooftops because I hate garbage collection.
Yes, I know, but maybe that's why it's skipping it. It's because it's doing its own stuff and blah, blah, blah.
No. It's even simpler than that, but find out in a couple of minutes. Let's get into the bad, and this one is going to make me sound like I've knocked my head on the ceiling or something and that I have a concussion, because it's going to make no sense coming out of my mouth.
Okay, I'm worried now.
So here's an issue with Flutter, is that oh my god, I can't speak tonight. It adheres strongly to native interface conventions.
And you don't like that?
Yeah, so this one is going to seem odd given my personal biases, but I mean it more as a business-specific point. The developers I work with at work do not design applications that are built around the iOS or Material design language. They are built around the branding of the client. And a lot of the times, because we have a history of using React Native and we don't actually care about what the widgets on the underlying platform look like, I think that Flutter boxes you into either making an iOS-looking app or a Material design-looking app, and you are going to be frustrated with the customization options available to you if you want to design an application that doesn't match either of those design languages. So it's very much like a work-specific complaint. Like, obviously, I would like my apps to look native on whatever platform they're on because that is how I would design the apps, but that is not how our designers design apps. And therefore, as someone who is implementing their design, I kind of have to care about this, even though it goes against my personal values.
Okay, that's fair. And was it, maybe I'm mixing it up with another UI framework, but when you mentioned that you have the iOS paradigms and the Material paradigms, they are assigned to both platform correctly, meaning that the code you write gets converted into the iOS UI framework and then...
Nope. No, 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 So that's the next point. This is where we get to the good part. So this is what I've labeled questionable multi-platform strategy.
Okay.
Flutter is pitched as being a multi-platform framework, but there is a very weird asterisk next to multi-platform framework because a Flutter application is either using Material UI or Cupertino UI, which is a different library which makes iOS looking apps. And each of these adheres to that platform's native UI conventions. However, it is not possible to write a single UI that adapts fully to which platform it's running on. So what this means is you can deploy an app written with Cupertino on Android. You can deploy a Material app on iOS. In fact, if you've used, Facebook Music. If you've used YouTube Music, it is a Flutter app in Material running on iOS.
Okay. No, that's good. Not good, but that's what I remembered of my discussion about Flutter, is that you could do the crossing, I would call it, where you can have the other platform's UI paradigms on your own platform.
Yes, but the weird thing, and the thing that seems insane to me, coming from React Native or other multi-platform frameworks, is you can't write a single Flutter app that appears as Cupertino on iPhone and appears on Material on Android, because they're separate UI frameworks.
Yeah, and you know what? That part, I understand why you say that, but that part made sense to me when we were having Flutter discussions. Because, and maybe you'll talk about that a bit later, so feel free to stop me. But my understanding is we always complain, and I will point you to the episode that Yannick talked about Xamarin, which... My recollection is Xamarin has both options, right? You can have more, you have access to the OS specific controls,
yep.
Or you can use a platform agnostic UI framework.
Yep.
And you were saying that the UI, the platform agnostic UI framework is real bad. Because I assume it tried to focus to the lowest common denominator. So I'm not surprised that they are kind of asking you to choose one, and then they figure out how to backport or ensure that the UI components from Material are both available on Material, easy to do because it's a one-to-one, and then backport them to iOS. And the same thing, more or less backporting Cupertino UI elements on Android, but at least you end up with a known set of components on both platform, and you kind of just keep the look and feel.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I understand the technical reasoning behind it. The only problem I have with that is that other frameworks offer this, and they're not all terrible. Like,
okay,
Xamarin is a bad example because, for example, like, it doesn't have really, for example, like, you can't define a platform agnostic navbar and navigation stack. Like, that doesn't really exist in Xamarin. You have like a weird in between, but like there's nothing that like presents it in the, like, you can't just do push your new screen and then have a navbar that looks like an iOS navbar on iOS and looks like an Android navbar on Android. It just doesn't even have that. So I think like it's a very anemic framework, and that was my main complaint about Xamarin Forms, is that a lot of the times I was looking for options that I know are available on both platforms, but they just didn't bother to implement it. And that's what was frustrating 95% of the time I was using Xamarin, is like, just expose the thing. I know it exists both places. But most of the time it was either the class was not there, or the method was not there, or the property was not there. And it was just frustrating. It was too limited. But on React Native, if you use the thing that says, hey, I have a navigation stack, I'm going to push it, it's going to look like an Android nav stack on Android, and it's going to look like an iOS nav stack on iOS. Nobody does that because nobody knows what a nav stack is, but they could.
Okay, I see what you mean. Yeah, no, I get you. I agree with you that I understand the technical trade-offs, and to me, as a non-cross-platform developer, strangely enough, it made a bit more sense. I don't know. Like, I don't know why. It's kind of weird to put words on it, but it's kind of like, to me, was, let's make a decision on which, more or less, like, human interface guidelines we want to use here, or does and then we stick with it on all the platforms.
It is a bit pervasive though, and the reason I want to talk about this is kind of goes into the next thing I wanted to talk about is. You were saying like backporting to native iOS components. Flutter does not use native UI components at all. Everything you see is re-implemented from scratch in an OpenGL context. And the proof of this is you can go to their widget gallery on the web and you can use all of Cupertino and all of Material in your browser in a WebGL context.
Oh,
they are the same widgets. And that's why it's faster on Android, because it's not using anything. It's just rendering straight to to OpenGL.
That now makes more
sense.
It's
like letterpress, really, if you remember back then.
No, I don't remember
that. Oh, well, Lauren Brichter made a game for iPhone, and instead of using like a game engine or whatever, he just implemented his own UI framework from scratch.
Now it rings a bell. And it was okay. Now I thought you meant letterpress as another UI framework. I was I didn't heard about this one. Yes, I know what you mean talking about.
So the issue with this is, first of all, like if you decide, hey, I'm going to present like a UI alert view equivalent, if your application is written in Material and you're running it on an iPhone, you get an Android-looking alert view.
Right, you get the YouTube app, more or less.
You get the YouTube app, which, like, I don't personally like the YouTube app that much, so I'm complaining about it.
Agreed.
There are tweaks. Like, I'm not going to say it is one-to-one the Android UI, because that's not true. There are tweaks, especially with navbars. Navbars, they at least look somewhat like iOS navbars, where the title is in the center, not to the left. And they have tweaked that layout in particular. I think the tab bar is slightly different to look more like an iOS tab bar, but that's it. Like those are the changes. And then everything else looks just like the Android app. And the problem with that is if you use Cupertino, it's all re-implemented. So if the intent is to look native, anyone who has our eyes can find inconsistencies, outdated UI components, and font rendering issues all over the place. Cupertino was last updated for iOS 13 UI. So if your app uses, if your app is running on a device that is newer than iOS 13, some widgets may have changed, and you may be using them in your app, and it's going to look the old way, and it's going to be weird. Obviously, I think like 90% of normal users do not give a shit. They are not going to be able to tell. Cupertino is honestly, it's pretty good re-implementation aside from the font rendering issues. If you were running on iOS 13, obviously. But nowadays, there are parts of it that you can very much point to and be like, this is wrong. And that sucks when you are someone picky like me who doesn't want to have visible things in your app where you can say, that's wrong. So I'm done bitching about the multi-platform strategy now. I'm going to move on to the next thing. But that is sort of my big rant about Flutter's sort of approach to multi-platform, is that I don't like it. You can be like UKV and it can be fine for like your standards. I'm a picky asshole, so it's...
Whoa. Don't get me wrong. There was a lot of discussion about it. I wasn't the biggest fan of it, but as I learned about its advantages, they did make sense. But for most of the changes, it was meant to kind of be like, oh, possibly we want to run on Android, possibly, maybe. And it was kind of like, yeah, why rewrite everything to just a maybe?
And let's be honest, like, I don't think anyone is actually going to use Cupertino if they do this. If they're going to use this at all, they're going to use Material.
Mm.
Like, I haven't seen anyone actually using Cupertino in production for Flutter. I've only seen people use Material. So it's like a way to slowly sneak more Android-looking apps onto the iPhone. And personally, I don't want that. So that's why I'm going to be biased against it. Next point in the bad section. So this one is incredibly strange to me. And originally, my point was just the ecosystem seems significantly less mature and less documented than React Native. But then people at work started pointing out to me, because I did this presentation at work as well. Yeah, but all of the popularity polls say that Flutter has like 3 to 4 times usage numbers of React Native. And I think I figured it out. Huh. And the reason really? Is maybe React Native is less used, but all of your React knowledge can transfer, and 80% of web pages on the internet use React now. So a lot of information you're going to find is going to help you is not specific to React Native. It's largely applicable to the React ecosystem. And because of that, you feel like you have a lot more stuff than you do. In fact, like last year, I was helping the person who was doing most of the React Native work at our company. I had never touched React Native before. I had helped him fix a bug because it was something I had figured out in React a couple months earlier, and it was just the same bug. So I think that is what makes this difficult to talk about, is if you are experiencing issues with React, you're going to have a lot of ease finding that information on the internet. If you're struggling with the native part of it, you are going to struggle a lot more. And I think the problem is that Flutter is both like the view framework thing that represents the hierarchy of the views that you're creating, and it's also all of the integration with the native components. And altogether, you are going to have less information for the Vue framework than you do for React. But maybe for the native integration parts, you're going to have slightly more information. I still think anecdotally for the research I did, I just had trouble finding information at all. Maybe this all happens in companies that don't write blog posts and don't share anything. I don't know. But I had a lot of trouble finding information helping me out with Flutter. And I honestly, like, even my weird compile time issues where a bunch of CocoaPods are exploding, like, I can generally find explanations by Googling the exact error message, and I had less luck doing that with Flutter. So I don't know what's up with that. It's just very strange where reality seems to contradict numbers that are published everywhere. Next thing is learning curve and value proposition is very odd. Like, I think the value proposition for businesses adopting React Native is very good because it means you can get up and running with mobile development in no time if you have React developers on your team. Flutter has none of that. You are learning a new language. You are learning a new view hierarchy definition method, which is basically exactly the same ideas and concepts as Jetpack Compose and Swift UI. But since most of these companies that are looking into multi-platform development are coming from the web side of things, I don't know why they would learn this. Because React Native exists and the value proposition is so good, I don't know why you would pitch this. There are weird patterns that are very different from what you would do in a React Native application that when people are going to see, oh, it's like React Native. Oh, all of the platforms I know from React Native do not work in this architecture. Let's just do a React Native app. It's very, very hard for me to see the business case for adopting Flutter unless you really, really want your UI on Android to run at 60 FPS. and if that's what you want, well, I don't know. I feel like it's essentially doing the same thing as Jetpack Compose does on Android. It's doing the same thing that Swift UI is doing. And it's even doing, like, if you want to do multi-platform, Kotlin multi-platform, which is technically a JetBrains technology, like, that runs on everything as well. All of these technologies do the same thing, and I don't know what Flutter's unique proposition is supposed to be other than it's run by Google. But Jetpack Compose is also run by Google.
Right.
And Kotlin Multiplatform is largely supported by Google as well.
Yes. And it's funny that you bring it up because that was, during the Flutter discussion, that was one of the big ones mentioned, Kotlin Multiplatform. I was like, what, 3 UI framework maintained by Google? For sure one will die.
Oh, well, it's not as much as Microsoft have going on right now, but...
True, but with Microsoft, they'll just maintain them for the next 20 years.
Yeah. And the last complaint on my Flutter list is one that is especially specific to me, which is development tools do not work well offline. If you have bad internet, like me, even if your dependencies are all fully up to date and downloaded, and you're not doing anything that seems like it should touch the internet at all, Flutter tools are just going to try to call home and stall and time out, and you're just not going to be able to run your code unless you get back online, and that sucks. So that is all the bad for Flutter, and this is the thing that's really funny to me, is like, yes, I gave a presentation at work that was like, I don't think this is a good technology for us. I mean, there are certain things about it that I like more than React Native. I think Dart is a pretty good language, and I actually like it a lot. And it has some interesting like compile time things going on to ensure safety that I think is really neat versus TypeScript. And its type system seems to be less of a fraud than TypeScript, which is also good. But ultimately, I'm like, why would we learn all of these things when it seems to be going against like how we need to develop apps based on the designs that our designers create? If the designers change their philosophy to how they design applications to always base off of material design language, maybe this becomes more attractive to us. And I think like the no dependency hell would be a lot easier for medical projects where you don't actually have to audit 1700 packages. You can just audit 30 instead. Sounds a lot easier. We would save a lot of hours of work doing that. But it seems so much at odds with the designs that we need to do, that we need to implement, that I had a hard time recommending it. And then like a couple of weeks later, we get the word that, hey, actually, we got the Flutter project and you're going to be leading it. So it's like, okay, well, now I have to ensure that we do as good a job as we can using these technologies. And that's why like in recent weeks, I've been trying to absorb as much information about how do you theme Flutter. And like there is a theme system built into Material, which is not actually, it seems more fleshed out for Material than it is for Cupertino. Let me just say that. And I've seen that Ubuntu actually rewrote all of their installer and their software, their app store equivalent. Like they rewrote all of that in Flutter recently and reskinned Material to look pretty distinct. So I'm actually looking at their source code to see like how did they do it, because it's really intriguing. And that's sort of also been a really interesting offshoot of my Linux adventures. It's like I didn't think it was going to lead me in this direction, but it did. And now I'm actually getting knowledge for it. So expect to hear more about Flutter in the coming months, because I'm going to be working with it very regularly, very soon. So look forward to that. And yeah, that's pretty much it for my whirlwind tour of my 2023 UI frameworks.
And I even have the competing argument for Flutter that will convince you it's the best.
Uh-oh.
PUBG Mobile uses it.
Wait, seriously?
Yes! I was on the website trying to find the kind of... while you were talking, trying to find the showcase to kind of, you were mentioning that you can run your apps in the browser and then see the components. I didn't find it, so I was digging around the website. And yeah, if you go to multi-platform Flutter on iOS, it's one of the showcased company or case studies, excuse me. PUBG Mobile is there. And it's funny because they also mentioned that eBay and Kijiji uses it. And I was like, yeah, they kind of look like Android apps on iOS. And I guess
that makes sense.
Why.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And there's a few other apps that's like, oh yeah, I understand that they use the Material design and on all platforms. And they kind of make sense. So, but the PUBG Mobile one made me laugh when I saw it.
I have no idea how that would work. I'm very curious now. I'm going to have to go look that up.
Then you should.
Yeah.
Good. I expect a bunch of links in the show notes for this episode. So if you're curious to find said links, you can find the show notes for this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/216216. You can find our back catalog of episodes at limitlesspossibility.net. The show is on the Fediverse. You can find it at limipo_podcast@mastodon.social. You can also find ourselves individually on the Fediverse. I am at luco@mastodon.social, and Yannick is at
Sakarina@icosahedron.website.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.